The team was a joint venture of the Atlantic Richfield Company, British Petroleum, and the largest Russian oil exploration company. It had been known for many years that this part of eastern Siberia was a geological twin to the North Slope region of Alaska and northern Canada, which had turned into vast oil fields. But what they had found had staggered them. From Kazachye on the River Yana all the way to Kolymskaya on the Kolyma was an oil field to rival the Persian Gulf. At precisely the same time, and only 600 miles away, another geology team was in the eastern extreme of the Sayan mountain range. Some of the semi-nomadic tribes in the area had brought into a government office some shiny yellow rocks. A survey team had been dispatched from Moscow State University. The first thing they'd found was an 80-ish man living alone with his herd and a rifle to fend off wolves. This citizen had lived alone since the death of his wife, 20 years before. He managed to shoot 3 or 4 wolves every year, and he kept the pelts as any hunter-herdsman might, but with a difference. First he took the pelts, and weighting them down with stones, set them in the small river that ran near his hut. In Western literature, there is the well-known story of Jason and the Argonauts, and their heroic quest for the Golden Fleece. It was not known until recently that the legend of the artifact sought was quite real. The tribesmen of Asia Minor had set the skins of sheep in their streams to catch the gold dust being washed down from deposits higher up, changing the pale wool fibers into something almost magical in appearance. It was no different here. The wolf pelts the geologists found hanging inside the old soldier's hut weighed a good 60 kilograms, and there were 34 of them. They learned that his name was Pavel Petrovich Gogol, that he'd fought against the fascisti in the Great Patriotic War as a sniper, and remarkably was twice a hero of the Soviet Union for his marksmanship. A somewhat grateful nation had allowed him to return to his ancestral lands. Pavel Petrovich knew the value of the gold he found, but he'd found his solitary life quite satisfactory. The gold deposit turned out to be noteworthy, perhaps as much as the South African strike of the mid-19th century, and that had turned into the richest gold mine in the history of the world. Both the oil and rock survey teams had traveled into the field with satellite phones, the more quickly to report what they found. This both teams did, coincidentally on the same day. The Iridium satellite communications system they used was not designed to be a secure system. This made life a lot easier for the National Security Agency. The parallel reports of the oil and gold strikes made their way swiftly up the chain of command, ending in a flash priority special national intelligence estimate, called an SNIE, destined for the president's desk to be delivered by his national security advisor, Dr. Benjamin Goodley. "Damn," the president observed. "Okay, Ben, how big are they, really?" "Mr. President, call it $200 billion in hard currency earnings over the next 5 to 7 years at minimum." "Good news for the Russians," Jack said, flipping through the SNIE. "About time they got lucky. Get a copy of this to George Winston. We want his evaluation of what this will mean to our friends in Moscow." Nomori's job for Nippon Electric Company involved selling high-end desktop computers and peripherals. For him, that meant the PRC government, whose senior bureaucrats had to have the newest and best of everything, from cars to mistresses, paid for by the government. As in many things, the PRC could have bought American brands, but it chose to purchase the slightly less expensive and less capable computers from Japan, in the same way that it preferred to buy Airbus airliners from the European maker rather than Boeings from America. That had been a card played a few years before to teach the Americans a lesson. America had briefly resented it, then quickly forgotten about it, in the way America seemed to handle all such slights, which was quite a contrast to the Chinese, who never forgot anything. When President Ryan had announced the reestablishment of their official recognition of the Republic of China government on Taiwan, the repercussions had thundered through the corridors of power in Beijing. The Chinese government was trying to shove that rage aside because they had to do business with the United States of America, now their number one trading partner, and the source of vast amounts of surplus cash, which their government needed to do the things which Nomori was tasked to find out about. And so here he was, in the outer office of the nation's prime minister. "Good day," he said with a bow and a smile to the secretary. She worked for a senior minister named Fang Gan. She was surprisingly well-dressed for a semi-ordinary worker in a nation where fashion statements were limited to the color of the buttons one wore on the Mao jacket.
"Good day. Are you Nomori?"
"Yes, and you are?"
"Lian Ming."
An interesting name. Lian in Mandarin meant graceful willow. She was short like most Chinese women, with a squarish face and dark eyes. Her least attractive feature was her hair, short and cut in a manner that harkened back to the worst of the 1950s in America, and then only for children in Appalachian trailer parks.
"You are here to discuss computers and printers?"
"Yes. I think you will find our new pin matrix printer particularly appealing."
"And why is that?"
"Do you speak English?"
"Certainly."
"Then it becomes simple to explain. If you transliterate Mandarin into English, the spelling, I mean, then the printer transposes into Mandarin ideographs automatically, like this," he explained, pulling a sheet of paper from his plastic folder and handing it to the secretary.
"Ah,"
the secretary observed. The quality of the characters was superb. "Would you like to see me demonstrate our new capabilities?"
"Sure, why not?"
"Excellent. But I will need you to authorize my bringing the hardware into the building, your security people, you see."
"Oh, yes."
"Excellent. I can be here with my equipment at, say, 10 in the morning."
"Good. The main entrance. They will be awaiting you."
"Thank you, Comrade Ming," Nomori said with his best officious bow to the young secretary, and probably mistress to her minister, the field officer thought.